Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, January 11th, 2022. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, County hears $187 million plan for facilities. Consultant, building new jail should be highest priority on list of projects. By Stuart Doreen. A consultant working with Midland County on a law enforcement complex master plan, including jail facilities, is recommending a series of improvements that could reach $187 million. Burns Architecture told Commissioner's Court that its recommendations and suggested priorities include that the county construct a new jail in a new location. While more expensive initially, it provides the best, most cost-effective long-term solution. This should be the county's highest priority, according to the executive summary of the report presented to county leaders on Monday. Estimated probable cost, $124 million. New Justices of the Peace offices and courtrooms, constable's offices, and a warrants office building on county-owned land adjacent to the current law enforcement complex on South Main Street. Estimated probable cost, $16 million. A new sheriff's office. While slightly more expensive initially, it provides the best long-term solution, according to the executive summary. Estimated probable cost, $31 million. A mental health transitional facility. At the time of this writing, there are indications that the state of Texas is considering construction of a mental health facility in Midland. Further discussion regarding this facility should be held until more details about the state's proposed facility are available, according to the executive summary. Estimate probable cost, $16 million. A representative of Burns Architecture told the court the very preliminary $187 million number would not include land costs. He recommended that commissioners begin to put into place the process for a conceptual plan. Once a conceptual plan, schematic designs, and construction documents are in place, the county would be ready to move forward. All three could take 12 to 15 months. The major facility item is the jail. The executive summary presented stated that the current jail, quote, has many shortcomings and requires an extensive renovation plus an expansion to accommodate the projected future capacity, unquote. It also said that renovating and expanding the current jail requires an estimated budget of $73 million versus $124 million and would take 5 to 6 years to complete versus 3 to 4. It was also stated that the county would incur costs of having to ship inmates to and from other jails during the process of renovating the current Midland County Jail. Other potential problems would be obtaining the needed land in that area south of downtown. The recommended plan would allow the county to construct a new jail that is more operationally efficient, capable of future expansions, and with a longer life expectancy. Potentially, 892 beds would be possible. The study showed the sheriff's office to be cramped, aging, and needing around twice as much room as the current office provides. There are also parking issues, according to Burns Architecture. Renovating the existing sheriff's office and constructing the additional building needed has an estimated budget of $20 million and would take 4 to 5 years to complete, the executive summary stated. Constructing a new sheriff's office at a remote site has an estimated budget of $31 million and would take 2.5 to 3 years to complete. The third priority for Justice of the Peace offices and courtrooms, constable offices, and warrants offices would bring all three into a single building, creating efficiencies, according to the report. Constructing this new building would take 2.5 to 3 years to complete, the report said. Likewise, a proposed mental health transition facility would take 2.5 to 3 years to complete. This is an entirely new concept intended to assist the mentally ill and ease the burden on the county jail by placing mentally ill persons who commit low-level crimes in an alternative setting and keeping them from being housed in the jail, the report stated. There wasn't much discussion on the item, as it was just a presentation. Precinct 1 Commissioner Scott Ramsey offered the following statement to the Reporter Telegram following the meeting. Several months ago, the Midland County Commissioner's Court began the process of evaluating the law enforcement complex. Because of the growth of Midland County and the surrounding area, our jail population has increased. We have been pushing the limits of capacity for some time. In order to get out in front of this issue, we commissioned an architecture firm that is an expert in law enforcement facilities to devise plans and programs looking forward 20 to 50 years. This study includes the jail, sheriff's office, Justice of the Peace constables, and mental health transition facility. I would like to stress that this is just an initial study. More work is necessary before we come to the citizens of Midland County with a proposed plan. Between now and then, we invite everyone to give their thoughts and inputs. Projects such as these are expensive and must be thoroughly studied so that we take care of today's needs as well as looking to the future. This article is entitled Council to Vote on Street Projects. Both items propose improvements to roadway pavement, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council will vote to approve the spending of $4.9 million on the fiscal year 2022 mill and inlay project that will remove existing distressed asphalt and replace it with new pavement on streets generally in Southeast and East Midland. The total cost is not to exceed $4.903 million, according to the city. Jones Brothers Dirt and Paving Contractors, Inc. of Odessa was the low bidder. Streets impacted include Weatherford Street, south of Golf Course Road, Tennessee Avenue, east of Carrizo Street, Marionfield Street, from Florida to Big Spring Street, Baird Street, from Industrial Avenue to Hicks Avenue, Hicks from Rankin Highway to Terrell, and Gist Avenue from Rankin Highway to La Mesa Road. Council to vote on $1.558 million for slurry seal. Another road item is the $1.558 million slurry seal project, with the approval of a contract with Viking Construction, Inc., of Georgetown. Slurry seal is a pavement preservation technique that includes the application of a mixture of water, polymer-modified asphalt emulsion, aggregate, and chemical additives to an existing asphalt concrete surface. These surface treatments are designed to extend the useful life of our paved streets. Slurry seal is the chosen application for residential and minor collector roadways. There was no list of streets where the project may take place. This article is entitled MDC Purchasing Two Downtown Properties as Part of Initiative. Move will make 2-acre block available for redevelopment, by Mella McEwen. Members of the Midland Development Corporation Board unanimously approved authorizing the purchase of property from the estate of J.L. Davis for $4.9 million. The West Texas Gas property at 210 North Big Spring Street and 211 North Colorado Street adjoin property already owned by the MDC and City of Midland. The Western United Life building and the lot where the building of the Southwest previously stood, according to Sarah Harris, MDC Executive Director. She said the move was made to further redevelopment downtown, explaining that the purchase will enable the redevelopment of a 2-acre block next to Centennial Park and give Midland the ability to attract significant projects. Previous projects for the Western United Life building property have fallen through or proven unsuccessful due to lack of parking. Purchasing the adjacent property ensures enough land is available for redevelopment and parking, making new projects viable, Harris told the Reporter Telegram by email. With the purchase of the West Texas Gas properties, there are multiple redevelopment opportunities at play. Each opportunity represents tens of millions of dollars of private capital investment in downtown, along with new job creation and property tax revenue to support Midland's taxing entities. Acquiring the additional property is a good economic decision for Midland and represents immediate value for the community. The agreement now goes to Midland City Council, where Stephen Lowry, the new MDC chairman, said indications are council members support the purchase. In other action, board members approved execution of a promotional agreement with Deanie Sferis, which was contracted last summer to assist in a fundraising campaign to fund the redevelopment of Hogan Park. The agreement with Deanie Sferis will last through the end of March. By then, City Councilwoman Lori Blong told board members, a new executive director should be in place to head a park conservancy structure that will operate and maintain Hogan Park. Deanie Sferis has been exceptional to work with, she said, with about half the $52 million redevelopment cost, just over $26 million, in pledges has been raised. Damon Kennedy, Vice President, Instructional Services at Midland College, offered board members an update on the college's Pre-K Academy Charter School and displayed renderings of the new Pre-K Academy building that will not only house the school, but students working to become educators. He said the college plans to offer an early childhood baccalaureate degree and is set to become only the second community college in the state to offer a certification program approved by the Texas Education Agency. Kennedy credited the $379,500 Midland College received from MDC for letting us clear a hurdle we needed to clear. Without that, we wouldn't be where we are today. He said the school has raised about $26 million, including $5 million pledged by the Midland College Foundation, of the $30 million cost of the new facility. Full funding is expected by mid-February, he said. Expectations are the first group of students, about 288, will start in the new facility in August 2023. Board members also said farewell to outgoing chair Wesley Bounds, who is stepping off the board he joined in 2015. During his tenure on the board, the MDC provided $12 million in funding for healthcare projects, $18 million for education, $1.3 million for quality of life projects like Hogan Park, Chris Davidson Opportunity Park, Midland Downtown Farmers Market, and Museum of the Southwest, and $25 million for infrastructure projects, according to Lowry. This is the community page. This article is entitled, Woman Killed After Her Car Hits Fence East of City, from Staff Reports. A 54-year-old woman died after her vehicle struck a fence Saturday afternoon east of Midland. Department of Public Safety officials reported that Louise Renee Pyle was traveling southbound in a 2017 Toyota Corolla on County Road 1140 when she failed to stop at a stop sign, crossed over County Road 120, and struck a fence. The accident took place around 5:01 p.m. Saturday, according to DPS. Pyle was wearing a seatbelt. This article is entitled, "Council Could Decide to Divvy Up Park Contracts," by Stuart Doreen. The City of Midland could divvy up the work that comes with maintaining parks. On today's agenda, there is an item with an option that, if approved, will divide the work into three options. Each will go to different companies, instead of the deal tabled in December that would have spent $8.4 million over 3 years with one. At the meeting in December, there were worries with going with just one company for a three-year period of time. The hope was splitting this item up would produce better outcomes in terms of maintenance and allow more companies to partner with the city on projects. So there are three options. The first calls for a contract with Aldridge Gardens at a cost of $2.8 million, as recommended by the review committee, based on confidence that the company has the equipment and manpower needed to provide the contract services. Option 2 calls for a contract to M3 Landscape Maintenance and Irrigation LLC, the committee's second choice. The company provided the lowest overall bid, $2.559 million. Option 3 awards the contract to three providers as follows: Lawn and Tree Tech LLC in the amount of $814,647 for maintenance of Scarborough Sports Complex, general parks, and no-mow areas. Aldridge Gardens in the amount of $982,446 for maintenance of Beale Park, Windlands Park, and parks with athletic fields. M3 Landscape Maintenance and Irrigation LLC in the amount of $707,850 for maintenance of Hogan Park, Butler Park, bimonthly mowing, occasional mowing, city offices, and additional maintenance services as required. The total for moving forward with the three proposed landscape maintenance contracts is $2,504,944, according to the city. The initial contract will be prorated for 8 months from February to September 2022. Staff recommends moving forward with one of these options. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, January 11th. Elfa Katanya Olguin. Elfa Katanya Olguin, better known as Mima to her loving family, left this earth to her eternal home on January 6, 2022. Elfa was born on April 24, 1938, to Magdaleno and Manuela Katanya in Vado de Piedra, Chihuahua, Mexico. Elfa is preceded in death by her parents, Magdaleno and Manuela Cataño, her husband Guadalupe Wally S. Olguin, sons Wally Olguin and Joe Angel Olguin, grandson Michael Aguilar, brother Herenio Cataño, and sisters Emma Cataño and Eva Cataño. She is survived by her children, Johnny Olguin, Lorraine, Danny Olguin, Veronica of Kerrville, David Olguin, Karina, Mary Aguilar, Trey, and Sarah Cardiel, all of Midland, 19 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren, as well as many siblings, nieces, and nephews. Funeral Mass will be at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, January 11th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church, with burial to follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Services are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Midland. To place online condolences, please visit www.willowbrk.com. Death Notices. Georgia Natividad. Georgia Natividad, 87, of Midland, passed away Saturday, January 8th. Viewing will be Friday, January 14th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., with a prayer service beginning at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service is set for Saturday, January 15th at 10 a.m. at Primera Iglesia Bautista. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. She is survived by her husband, Daniel Hernandez, and two sons, Henry Natividad and Pete Natividad, 8 grandchildren and 16 great-grandchildren. Juan Dominguez. Juan Dominguez, 72, of Midland, passed away January 8th. Viewing will be from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Tuesday and Wednesday, January 11th and 12th, at the branch at NPW. A rosary will be recited at 7 p.m. Wednesday, January 12th, at the branch at NPW. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, January 13th, at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church, with interment following at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Catherine Cassidy Baker. Catherine Kate C. Baker, 80, of Midland, passed away Thursday, January 6th. Rosary will be Wednesday, January 12th at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral service will be at St. Anne's on Thursday, January 13th at 12 p.m. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. She is survived by her husband, Bill Baker, two daughters, Elisa Felix and Sheila Rice, 4 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren, along with several cousins, nieces, and nephews. Matthew Brian Granado. Matthew Brian Granado, 24, of Midland, passed away Thursday, January 6th. The family will receive friends from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesday, January 11th at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 12 p.m. Wednesday, January 12th at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Survivors include his mother, Brenda Ortiz Granado, and partner Sergio Garcia, and his father, Joey Granado, and spouse, Brittany Granado. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Michael Brown. Michael Brown, 53, of Midland, passed away January 4th. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, January 14th at Visionary Hollowell Community United Methodist Church, with interment following at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Royce Clayton Mitchell, Jr. Royce Clayton Mitchell, Jr., 68, of Odessa, passed away on January 3rd at Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. He is survived by 3 children, Sean Garrett Mitchell, Yesenia, Donnie Mitchell, Ann, and Katie Mitchell, 7 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, and 1 sister. A memorial will be held on Monday, January 10th, beginning at 12 p.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home. Tony Armendariz Lopez. Tony Armendariz Lopez, 66, of Midland, passed away Thursday, January 6th. A viewing will be on Tuesday, January 11th, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home, with an evening prayer service and a rosary at 7 p.m. He is survived by 2 sons, Tony Lopez Jr. and Julian A. Lopez, 2 daughters, Regina Sushil and Valerie G. Lopez, 3 brothers, Bobby Champion, Eddie Salas, and Candelario Lopez, 3 sisters, Sally Lopez, Marjorie Lopez Hernandez, and Christina Sanchez, 10 grandchildren, 4 great-grandchildren, as well as many aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, January 10th. Crisis Center marking 40 years. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. The Crisis Center of West Texas is marking 40 years, and executives say there have been changes for the better through those decades. Executive Director Lori Dunham said it is amazing to her just how far the domestic violence movement has come, even if you take the Crisis Center out of it. Quote, "We're now in a place where we have a partnership with OPD and the Sheriff's Department, where they have a program where if they respond to a scene and a survivor fits a certain amount of criteria, that law enforcement officer is helping them call us from the scene," Dunham said. "It wasn't anything like that even 10 years ago, but to think back 40 years ago, I would imagine that those who were helping form that original task force would be amazed at how much progress not only the movement has made, but this agency has made," she added. One of the main things that stands out is the expansion of its prevention education program, which is aimed at stopping the cycle of violence and creates awareness of the center. Dunham added that law enforcement is now highly trained in domestic violence. Quote, "We enjoy in Odessa a very unique partnership with our law enforcement that is very important. They are very important to us," she said. The Lethality Assessment Protocol, or LAP, was instituted in Ector County in March 2020. Quote, "That's something that was developed in Maryland and has found its way to other states. It's an evidence-based program," Dunham said. Crisis Center also trains businesses to become certified partners. Hannah Horick, Communication and Development Coordinator at Crisis Center, said some of the organizations that have signed are Meals on Wheels of Odessa, the Odessa Chamber of Commerce, and the Pride Center of West Texas. The program launched in October 2021. Quote, "We ask basically three things of the certified partner. The first is that they take our three R's training, and the R's are recognizing, responding, and referring. That's about a 45-minute training, and it's essentially the dynamics of domestic violence and how to identify it, and how to help someone who might be experiencing it," Horick said. Continuing the quote, "Then we ask that they display our tear-offs in their bathrooms or other slightly more private places for employees and customers. Then the last thing is we ask that they post, we have a static cling that says CCWTX Certified Partner, and we ask that they will display that in the window and let us take a photo of the group that we can share on social media," Horick said. The 3Rs program is based on a program called Cut It Out, which is designed for hairstylists and salon employees. Quote, "They wanted to target salon employees because they get lots of one-on-one time with women and with people in general, but particularly women, and then they might be able to recognize bruises on someone or have more relationship conversations than a survivor might get to have with a member of the general public. So we adapted that to be able to fit a lot of different business environments," she added. The Crisis Center serves 9 counties, including Ector. Another aspect, she said, that stands out is the collaboration with many agencies in Odessa and Midland and the counties they serve. The agency was formed in August 1980 as the Rape Crisis Task Force by Lieutenant Bianca Brister of the Odessa Police Department to address the needs of victims of rape, information from the Crisis Center said. At a meeting held in January of 1981 at Odessa College, Brister and K. Maley Schnanzer presented the need for a Rape Crisis Center in Odessa. Quote, "The dynamic duo pointed out the importance of volunteers who could respond to the needs of victims as well as to promote sexual assault awareness and personal safety programs," By the end of May 1981, Brister and Stanzer had recruited 78 people, including Lorraine Bonner, now Lorraine Perryman, the Director of Public Information for ECISD and future mayor of Odessa, and Margaret Burton, city council member and later director of Meals on Wheels. These women and other civic leaders formed the Odessa Task Force to establish a rape crisis center, the website said. By October of 1981, the task force had collected more than $22,000, the site said. The first board of directors was elected to then set the policy and direction of the center. Bill Duff served as the first president of the 9-member board. The city of Odessa donated space at the Red Cross building on the corner of 3rd and Lee Street. The city provided office furniture and agreed to pay for utilities. ECISD, El Paso Products, and the city of Odessa provided office supplies. Brister and Stanzer acquired volunteers, money, housing, and supplies to open the center in less than 1 year and without grant money, the site said. The site said the Odessa Rape Crisis Center was incorporated November 5, 1981. The federal government granted a 501c3 not-for-profit tax designation in January 1982. The center has done a mail-out campaign for the 40th anniversary. Dunham said she expects to have a celebration after the February 5th Dancing with the West Texas Stars. In a year's time, the crisis center could have close to 100 volunteers, if you count Wonder Girls Camp and people volunteering for community service hours, for example. Originally, Dunham said they were serving female survivors of sexual assault, and then between the years of 2000 and 2004, they expanded to a broader crisis intervention service. At that time, the name was changed from Odessa Rape Crisis Center to the Crisis Center. Between 2000 and 2004, Dunham said, they addressed all types of crises. On September 6, 2001, with the help of more than 60 volunteers and contributions from the community, they opened Angel House. Quote, "Our first resident entered the doors 2 hours after we cut the ribbon," Dunham said. In 2014, she said, the mission was narrowed to respond, shelter, educate, and end domestic and sexual violence in West Texas. From her understanding, Dunham said, from 2000 to 2014, Crisis Center was handling all types of crises. Then in 2014, the board said, let's narrow the focus, and went back to domestic violence and sexual assault. That's when they developed that mission statement, response, shelter, and educate. Dunham said they still get calls from people who need help with their utility bills, for example, but they have a robust list of people they can refer callers to, she said. Dunham said they probably narrowed the mission because domestic violence funding is very specific. In 2014, the name was changed to Crisis Center of West Texas. Dancing with the West Texas Stars was launched in 2015. Quote, it's almost our only true fundraiser. We do a mail-out campaign, but currently it is our only what I would consider a major fundraiser. In February 2020, we had 1,000 people attend, and we got in right under that line right before COVID, Dunham said. The 2022 stars and professionals are Alejandro Barrientos and Kelsey Tanner, Colby Brazil and Peekaboo Weisenhunt, Dr. Gassen Fanowas and Kristen Carter, Paige Halfen and Jordan Johnson, Angie Hurt King and Noah Guzman, J. Ross Lacey and Madison Lowen, Bridget Myers and Janelle Bell, Camila Rueda and Enrique Romero, Alicia Siverson and Richard Ortiz, Aaron Thomas and Emily Hamer, Sean Trotter and Brooklyn Anderson. The crisis center has seen its numbers rise slowly back up since COVID. Quote, certain things went down during COVID. The shelter went down a little bit, whereas people asking for counseling hours went up. We almost tripled. We had to hire another counselor, so people were reaching out more in the non-resident capacity and less in the resident. And then once everyone started getting vaccinated, we saw a little bit of an increase, and we're almost back to where we were at the shelter. But honestly, there are still people who I know are weighing that with variants and all the things that are still out there, weighing that communal living, even though we do have a very large space and they have their own room and their own bathroom there. They're weighing out, do I wait it out a little longer? Do I enter communal living? They could be waiting on their last booster or their last vaccine, or they could be waiting to see what happens with the next variant, Dunham said. The Louise Wood Angel House opened in 2019. It has 61 beds and 16,000 square feet, and they can put up a couple of cribs, Dunham said. Dunham said they have never filled it, but they have come close. Quote, one of the goals in the building, the new facility, was to eliminate the waiting list, Dunham said. The Lila Smith House was in Fort Stockton, but it was discontinued in 2019. Since December 1, 2020, the center has served 534 total clients, 370 adults, and 156 children. 255 are shelter residents, and 279 were non-residents. 82% were female, and 18% were male. There were 19 clients under the age of one, and a total in a year of 13,254 shelter bed nights, 1,851 hours of counseling, and 649 community presentations, which include schools. Shelter bed nights are heads in beds, Dunham said. Their average length of stay is 23 days. Quote, that's very fluid based on what their needs are, she said. According to local law enforcement, they saw a decrease in almost every crime except domestic violence. Quote, often a survivor gets their respite from their abuser going to work, so that's the time when they have time to plan or make phone calls or do those things. If everyone stayed home during lockdown and they didn't have that respite, we can't really quantify, but we know that impacted reporting. It also impacted opportunities for violence, because the more that you're together, the more opportunities there are for violence, Dunham said. After things opened up again, people came back gradually. It was not rapid at all. It was just very steady. It was a very steady increase to what looks like pre-COVID numbers, she added. The year HORIC started, 2017, the center served 310 clients. Its peak year since then was 686 clients in 2019. Quote, most years we get close to doubling that. It's shifted a little over the years, but to have that big of a jump just within a two-year period really put it as testament to expanding our staff, expanding our services, and doing a lot more community awareness and a number of other factors, Horick said. She added that the culture around talking to survivors has changed. Police are trained to identify the primary aggressor. Quote, it's been a game changer in law enforcement. I'm proud that Odessa has been able to maintain services for survivors for so long without a gap, and that's been something we've been able to continue to offer. But there is certainly a part of me that is disappointed that there's still so much need, Horick said. Continuing the quote, I like to think that the world is really different now than it was in 1981, and yet there are still so many people in dangerous or abusive relationships. I like to think that in 40 years, we will have a much stronger education focus and the actual client services side would be smaller, she added. I think that's certainly true of how we are from 40 years ago. We do a much higher percentage of education and prevention work than I can possibly imagine they did when they first opened. So I would like to think that trend will continue." End quote. Don't take your vision for granted. Get an eye exam. This was written by Carol A. Keats, Chief Nursing Officer, Odessa Regional Medical Center. Sight, I think, is one of the things I always took for granted. I wear glasses and contacts, but blindness was not something I really thought of as a possibility. That was until my husband had an accident in the spring of 2019. In that accident, he ruptured the globe of one of his eyes. Despite the best efforts of wonderful surgeons and caregivers, he is now completely blind in that eye. He was already essentially blind in his other eye because of another accident when he was in his 20s. We have had to make many, many changes to our lives since the accident in 2019 because of his lack of vision. It certainly makes you realize what a gift sight is when you live with someone whose sight is no longer a given, and I no longer take it for granted. Even with all the changes we have made, I am constantly amazed by how well my husband has adapted to this new situation. Part of the reason I think he has done so well is because one of his closest friends has been blind since he was a teen. This friend went to college, teaches at a high school just like my husband, is married, has a daughter, and has an incredibly full life. His blindness has been a hurdle to overcome, but he has never let it be a barrier. His success helped my husband be successful too. That friend lost his vision because of glaucoma. Glaucoma is rare in young people, but it does happen. When I think of glaucoma, I always think of this friend, because the other thing about glaucoma is it is very manageable if it is caught early. But with him, it wasn't detected until it was too late. He is the example of why glaucoma awareness is so important. According to the Glaucoma Research Foundation, more than 3 million people in the U.S. and 60 million people worldwide have glaucoma. The National Eye Institute is projecting that by 2030, that number will be more than 4 million people in the U.S. alone. The World Health Organization states there are 120,000 people in the U.S. and 4.5 million people worldwide that are completely blind due to glaucoma. Glaucoma is the leading cause of irreversible blindness. One of the reasons glaucoma is so problematic is that it is completely asymptomatic. It's a little mind-boggling to think about, but people who have glaucoma can lose up to 40% of their vision and not even notice because it happens so gradually. Glaucoma is a broad term for a group of eye diseases that cause damage to the optic nerve. The two main kinds of glaucoma are primary open-angle glaucoma and angle-closure glaucoma. These two conditions raise the pressure inside the eye, known in medical terms as the intraocular pressure. That high pressure damages the nerve. Because high intraocular pressure is asymptomatic and people don't notice the vision loss until there has been a huge amount of damage done, the best method for finding glaucoma early is an annual eye exam. That way, the high pressures are detected before there is significant vision loss, and sight-saving treatments can begin immediately. Glaucoma doesn't have a cure, but treatment can essentially stop progression of the disease. Glaucoma is genetically linked to people of Latino and African American heritage. It's as much as 8 times more common in those populations than in other ethnicities. People of Asian descent are at higher risk than Caucasian people as well. That genetic link also means if you are diagnosed with glaucoma, it is important that you let your family members, especially siblings, know so they are vigilant in getting their eyes checked. Glaucoma is most common in middle-aged and elderly adults, but it can happen to people of all ages. Those at highest risk for glaucoma are people of African, Asian, and Hispanic descent, people over 60, diabetics, people who are severely nearsighted, and anyone with a family member who has glaucoma. Please add to your list of New Year's resolutions to get an eye exam, especially if it's been more than a year since your last exam and you are in one of those high-risk groups. I can tell you from experience, sight is not something you ever want to take for granted.
Good morning, this is Kim. I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, January 11th, 2022. COVID cases jump in Odessa again. Odessa is seeing another spike in COVID cases. In a span of 96 hours, inpatient COVID numbers at Medical Center Hospital jumped by 30. The number of COVID patients at MCH as of Monday morning was 86, which was almost nearly double from a week ago. Numbers as of January 4th were 47. MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin said via phone Monday afternoon about the most recent spike. "It's definitely what we didn't want to see," he said. "It's not unexpected, but it's something that we didn't want. The rate has grown substantially over the last 7 to 10 days. We can directly contribute that to holiday gatherings, whether that's Christmas or New Year's." Tippin said he can't be sure of the type of variant that's spreading throughout the city and county, but he expects it is Omicron. He also said that there are cases of people battling influenza and COVID, which is called Florona. Due to COVID increasing, Tippin said the hospital will maintain its current visitation policies, but he explained that could change if numbers continue to rise. MCH's visitation policy can be seen here, tinyurl.com/NH5JDM67. "We have talked about visitation, but we haven't done anything as of right now," Tippin said. "Our policy will stay the same, but we are monitoring that all the time. If we wake up and we are at 100 or 120 by Friday, I think we are going to have to do something to slow it down, to protect the staff and the patients in here, because we have patients that don't have COVID. We have to remember that. We have to protect those people and our staff." Tippin said elective surgeries will also continue, because he doesn't want to add to the current backlog of those procedures. Tippin also said that could also change if COVID numbers continue to increase. "I really want to keep our elective surgeries moving," Tippin said. "There's just such a backlog of elective surgeries that I don't want to delay those anymore. Then again, if all my surgery staff is sick, I might not have the choice. We are going to watch that very close." As of Monday morning, there are 29 COVID patients in critical care, with 21 of those on ventilators. The critical care numbers include 15 unvaccinated, 9 vaccinated, and 5 unknown. Of the 21 COVID patients on ventilators, there are 12 unvaccinated, 6 vaccinated, and 3 unknown. School days. School days to be staged Friday. The lighter side of school life will be explored in an Odessa High School Theater Department production of School Days on Friday. Theater head director Cherie LeMaster said the production is supported by a grant from the Education Foundation. They weren't able to stage it last year because of COVID. Performances will be held all day at the OHS Performing Arts Center with an evening staging at 6:30 p.m. It's $1 during the day and $5 for the evening and $3 for students. The art department is putting up panels that have to do with the theme of the show, which will be depicted in a series of scenes. It covers matters that students face every day at school, such as trying to get through the hallways, bullying, and the correct way to handle someone who is having a seizure and dress code issues, LeMaster said. LeMaster said about 20 students from grades 9 through 12 are involved. Over the years, she said, the production has had many titles such as hashtag relatable, Silver Linings Playbook, and Peer Issues. And each one is just a little bit different because a different group of kids have written it. This one is, I think, the funniest of the group. It's taking the different issues that they face and kind of poking fun at it in a fun way, and then talking about how to deal with those issues in a positive way, LeMaster said. 17-year-old Caitlin Crowder is the director. Crowder said she set out to make this show different from previous years. I felt like the goal was to make it more relatable in a sense where it is not a focus on deep issues like bullying, because that's been the focus in the past. So if we were able to make it more about general school issues, then it will be more relatable. In the past, this show in particular has been focused on addressing issues along the line of mental health. But we tried to slow that down because a lot of those issues have been in high increase because of COVID and having to deal with isolation and quarantine. So in order to connect toward a more sensitive audience than it's ever been, we tried to limit that and tried to make it more upbeat than something that's a little more sad, Crowder said. She added that it was harder to think more positively because the issues they talked about in the past, like depression and having to deal with anxiety and ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, are all things the theater students have an easier time talking about because they are so connected. In this production, Crowder said, they have stepped out of their comfort zone. Students have been working on the production since August, with breaks for when panels and other items were brought into the theater, LeMaster said. This being her senior year, the production is extra special for Crowder. LeMaster really let me take more charge into it. She wants to give me more experiences and opportunities to go into the directing world, Crowder said. She added that directing is something she would like to pursue. Having these experiences will let me have an outlet to do that, Crowder said. She added that she got involved with theater because her mom wanted Crowder to channel her energy into something beneficial. It helped me a lot in so many ways, like when I'm having to read a book for my English class and I have to learn about the character that I'm reading about. My experience in theater has been a great assistance toward that because I have to play different characters all the time to create the world that they live in. And so when I study literature, it intertwines with that, and I feel more connected to the characters, and I feel like I get a better understanding, Crowder said. Currently, Crowder plans to attend college at California Institute of the Arts. 15-year-old freshman Josh Brindley and 16-year-old sophomore Alaya Havner are narrators for the production. Brindley said he was drawn to being part of a production and having a supportive group around him. Havner said they were talking about a lot of issues that a lot of students have at school, but we wanted to take it to like a funnier part because of the pandemic. We wanted people to laugh and be able to have a good time, and it just evolved into something really funny that we put a lot of effort into, Havner said. It was easy to write the scenes because they projected all their troubles onto it, but when they tried to make it funny but serious, it was a bit more difficult, she said. I think it was also the issue that posed the problem of trying to make it funny without demeaning the issues, without demeaning what was going on through the pandemic. I think that we've done a good job of tying that together in this show and showing that there are issues that you can joke about, Brindley said. Havner said they end the show with things that happen at OHS that everyone experienced, that show that high school isn't always so humorous. High school isn't always something to joke about. The stuff that happens, she said. She said the class got really close by reading about each other's issues, and everyone was like, well, I wrote about this because of this, and it was kind of like, oh, I know, that we can talk about it. And we got really close as a class because of it, Havner said. She added that people should come to see the show, because so much work went into it, and some of the students involved have never been on stage or experienced performing for an audience. This is a good thing because we all put our efforts into it, and now we get to share the effort that we put in for people, Havner said. COVID-19 news, by the numbers, COVID in the basin. Ector County, 30,143 total cases, 579 deaths. Midland County, 30,715 total cases, 422 deaths. Texas, 5,039,605 total cases, 76,502 deaths. U.S. cases, 60,240,751 total confirmed and 835,302 deaths. Find out more at covidinthebasin.com or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. See the ECISD COVID-19 dashboard at tinyurl.com/Y6NTPTUQ. Free COVID-19 PCR tests. The City of Odessa Incident Command is partnering with Curative to offer the COVID-19 PCR test drive-through from 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at the corner of 2nd Street and Grant Avenue. Insurance information will be requested. If no insurance, test will be free. To book an appointment, visit curative.com. Free COVID-19 testing. Community Wellness America is hosting free COVID-19 testing for ages 5 and older throughout January. Testing schedule is as follows. Fridays, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Ector County Department of Health, 221 North Texas Avenue. Sundays, 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Connection Christian Church, 4241 Tanglewood Lane. Mondays, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. All participants are asked to wear a mask. Citizenship is not required. Vaccination status is not required. For more information, call 432-349-0522 or visit communitywellnessamerica.org. Quick Hits, the Sandhills Stock Show and Rodeo. The Sandhills Stock Show and Rodeo has been scheduled through Saturday at the Ector County Coliseum, 4201 Andrews Highway. Rodeo performances start at 7:30 p.m. For tickets and full schedule of events, visit sandhillssr.com. Lunch and Lecture, Permian Basin Petroleum Museum, 1500 I-20 Midland, has scheduled a lunch and lecture with MOTRAN President James Beaucamp from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. today. Admission is free. Drinks and dessert will be provided. Visit tinyurl.com/YW4HA3B5.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.